economies to order. Today is February 15th, and today we'll be looking at some overviews with the Minnesota Corn Growers Association, the Soybean Association, and also the wheat growers, the barley, the turf, and the potato and the sugar beet industry. In your packets, you'll find three handouts. One is from the Minnesota Canola Council, one from the Minnesota Wild Rice, and one from the Minnesota Alfalfa and Forage Industry. They are unable to be here, but we would ask that you look those items over. Another thing I'd like to point out is today is Dairy Day at the Capitol, and we certainly appreciate all of the representatives from the dairy industry here today. Also, there will be a reception tonight at the Cali Inn, so everybody want to make sure if they get a chance to go over to the reception. So with that said, we'll go ahead and start with the overviews. The first one will be the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Mr. Greg Schwartz, the president of the association, would you please come forward, introduce yourself, and introduce yourself and state your position for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Greg Schwartz. I farm near Le Sueur, raise corn, soybeans, and turkeys on a typical family farm. We do have some information we want to share with you about the state of the industry of corn, and you do have that information in your packet. A little background on the organizations and the structure that we have. It's not a whole lot different than some of the other commodity groups, but the association side, which I am the president of Minnesota Corn Growers Association, is really the grower side, and the Research and Promotion Council is really the checkoff side. So you have two distinct organizations with one common goal, which is to identify and promote opportunities for corn farmers while enhancing quality of life. Can everyone hear me all right? The association was founded back in 1978, and we have about 6,000 members in Minnesota. That puts us in the top one or two. We kind of alternate with Iowa as far as the largest corn grower association in the country. We have 46 different counties that are organized, and then we are part of a national association, and our office is in Shakopee. We have nine staff there. Tim Gerlach, who is here with us today, is our executive director. And we have 19 members on the board scattered throughout the state. The Research and Promotion Council is really the checkoff side of things. So the one cent a bushel checkoff that goes through the Department of Ag and comes back to the council for research and promotion is specifically just for that. So we have the Research and Promotion Council side. They do their thing. And the growers do their thing with the legislature and some of the lobbying things that the council cannot do. So just some background on where the industry is. Minnesota set a corn production record in 2010 with nearly 1.3 billion bushels in production, and that averages out to about 177 bushels an acre. 7.3 million acres were planted to corn in 2010, and really if you look back in maybe the last 10 years, that number has really not changed all that much. People tend to talk about things in the media about how many more corn acres are being raised. It really hasn't changed all that significantly over time. And you can see that the top counties for corn production. As in the nation, we rank about fourth in production, and our yields have gone up 224% in the last 50 years, and that increase, the rate that our yields are increasing is really accelerating as we move forward. And here you can see the breakdown of how corn products are used in the state. And the one thing that I would point out that's probably most important out of all those pieces of the pie, you can see that there's still 40% that we export out of the boundaries of this state. And one of the things that we, the corn growers, and most farmers in Minnesota want to add value to that production here. That means jobs, that means tax base, and that means good things for rural communities. On the ethanol side, we rank fourth in production with 21 plants producing a little over a billion gallons, and much of that is exported outside of our borders as well, but that's been a very good thing for Minnesota farmers in the past. And in closing, just to highlight a few of the things that are our priorities for the upcoming year, what are the things that corn farmers and the corn growers especially are focusing on. Number one is water quality and the whole impaired waters issue and how we approach the TMDL process, trying to bring new science that better reflects what's actually happening on the farm, so that as reports come forward and if any changes are going to be made on the farm, we want to make sure that those things are actually going to make a difference and an improvement both in production and also in water quality. Ethanol permitting is also something we're focusing on. The Senate File 1 was a good start. Getting those permits in and out of agency in a quicker and more deliberate means is something that we're all for. But also, when you look back at when PCA made some changes as far as how they maintain or keep the actual fines that are levied, back 3 years ago, I think the level of fines was, you know, a couple hundred thousand, and it quickly grew to over $2 million, and that was no coincidence. So we'd really like to see that change as well. Fueling infrastructure is also something where we hope we can do more as we move forward. Minnesota does lead the nation in E85 pumps and blender pumps. More of those blender pumps give consumers choice on what type of fuel they really want to put in. And in the end, at the end of the day, I think that's what most consumers really just want, options. One of the other things that I just wanted to mention was that as we move forward and you hear from a lot of different groups, you're going to hear a lot of things about where prices are, and we know corn prices are high. If you look at that 1.3 billion bushels of production at today's price, that's over $7 billion, and that's just the raw commodity. You process that, it means a lot more in jobs and benefit to the state. But our production costs are magically following that same trend. So as we move forward, we're going to be challenged to be more efficient on the farm, and at the end of the day, when we really look back at what we're doing probably 20 years from now, we're going to realize that we really need more research and promotion in production, because no matter how the market forces work as you move forward, we know we're going to need to feed and fuel more people, and the real answer is going to be, how do we best utilize every acre of ground to produce the most energy and food for the people of the world? So I'd be open to any questions at this time.
Do any committee members have any questions for Mr. Schwartz? Senator Kielash?
Mr. Schwartz, just wondering if with the number of acres that are being in corn production, do we have any idea how much of it's irrigated? One of the things where it goes to your water quality issues, because one of the things we're looking at recharge rates and things like that in the aquifers. Can you just expand on that a bit?
I don't have that right on top of my head. I did serve on the water task force in the water framework work that's been done in that proposal that was just submitted a couple weeks ago. As a state, I think our total land irrigated is somewhere around 3 to 5%. It's really not a large portion. Like when you get into Nebraska and those areas, you know, there you're talking half or whatever those percentages are. They're much different than what they are here. But I want to say 2 to 3%. Department of Ag has all that stuff, and I know we went through it. I just don't have it on the tip of my tongue.
Thank you.
It is not more than 5%.
And anything about the recharge issues for those?
You know, I think I shouldn't pretend to know more about water than I really do, but I think when we worry about those things in Minnesota, we, as you go further southwest, water recharge rates are much more of an issue, because there you have pockets of good water. And when you get into the aquifer that the Mount Sinai, which covers most of the metro and southern Minnesota, those recharge rates are something most people in any other state would love to have, because they're really not a big issue.
Thanks.
Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schwartz, I see, you know, biofuels are a couple of your priorities. Just out of curiosity, do you know with the latest EPA ratings on what cars will allow to use a higher level of ethanol, what percentage of our fleet would be allowed to use the higher percentage? Do you know that?
It's between 50 and 60%, I believe, right now. And the car companies, most U.S. car companies, have told us they're moving towards 100% of their fleet being built as flex fuel compatible vehicles. I think the real trick is to, over time, you know, there's older models that, of course, we just have to deal with that are not equipped that way. So we're moving in the right direction as far as hard and fast numbers. I'd say it's right in that range.
All right. Thank you.
Any other committee members have questions for Mr. Schwartz? Hearing none, thank you very much, Greg, for coming in and joining us today. We truly appreciate it. Next, we'll have the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and I believe Barb Overly will be representing them. And Barb, you're a board member of the National and the State Association, is that correct?
That's correct.
And when you get situated, would you state your name and your position for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Barb Overly, and I serve both on the state and the National Soybean Growers Association Board. And as Greg pointed out with corn growers, we have a similar setup where we are made up of both promotion side as well as a grower side. Our promotion side is an elected council by all the soybean farmers who provide money to the checkoff, which on for soybeans, it's 0.5% of whatever the price of soybeans are at the time. This happens to be a picture of that board. I sit on the growers board, and we are a 41-member board, and we are appointed by our counties, by our organized counties. And we try to represent all of the farmers in Minnesota. We are, to be on the growers side, you have to become a member, because since the Promotion Council cannot spend any money on lobbying or advocacy. That is the grower side of the picture, and so that's where we spend our money on that side. We have five program areas: research and tech transfer, international marketing, domestic marketing, education, and communication. See, these are our seven main priority areas for 2011, and number one is higher soybean yields. This is done through research. We are not going to gain any more acres in this country. In fact, we're losing acres from urban sprawl, so if we're going to raise more soybeans, it's going to have to be through yields. And that then falls back on public research, which a lot of that is done at the Minnesota University of Minnesota. Biodiesel is one of our big priorities. Animal ag, we always say when you eat meat, you are eating soybeans, because many, many soybeans go into all those animals to feed them. Water quality is a big issue with us. We want to keep that water for our uses, and so it's up to us to keep it clean, and it's to our advantage to do so. Biotechnology, we're still having some problems worldwide with the acceptance of biotech foods. So if we're going to continue to feed this world, we're going to have to continue in that direction. And then a new one this year is amino acids. Since we live so far north, we tend to have low protein, which a lot of our buyers see as not a good food product. But we are finding that the amino acids are really more important to the feed industry than the protein level is. Oh, how did that do that to me? Now what do I do? How did it go clear to the end?
I'm not sure what you did, Bart.
I'm not sure what I did either.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jerry Schoenfeld, who work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers as well while they're waiting here, and really here just as a support person for Barb today. But if she thinks I'm going to do something with technology, she's totally missing the boat, I'll tell you that.
Oh, we're a good pair then.
Thank you, Gary.
Skip over. There should be more slides beyond that. Well, we may just have to punt here and go without them.
This was the one you were just on.
Yeah, and then it should go. It goes to the end. And why it goes to the end, I don't know. Well, anyway, I'll proceed without the slides. You'll just have to believe me when I give you these facts. The soybean supply demand has been extremely high and has continued to stay that way. The demand is up 145% since 1990, higher than any other commodity. We also continue to crush and export over half of our crop. And, of course, a lot of that is due to China. China is one of our largest buyers. They bought probably 10 times more than the next closest purchaser, which would be Mexico. So as long as the Chinese stay in there, as you know, there was a Chinese team here not too long ago, and Governor Dayton met with them, and they wrote an order for 423 million bushels of soybeans at that time. In our country, when we get more money, we tend to buy more toys. In third world countries, when they get more money, they buy food. And as part of that, they go from a rice vegetable diet to a meat diet. It takes soybeans to feed livestock, and so thus that raises our demand level, and it also raises their living standards. Global consumption has continually grown since 1990, and we see no reason that it should not continue on that same plane. Like I said before, right now the U.S. is the number one producer of soybeans in the world, but Brazil and Argentina are creeping up on us rapidly, and the only way we are going to maintain the forefront is to increase our yields, because like I said before, there probably is no more land to put into production, and a lot of it's going into parking lots. Public research is one of our biggest assets there, and because of the University of Minnesota, which is funded by a lot of our checkoff dollars, they have done a lot of research on this. Some of our biggest problems are the soybean aphid. Just about the time we think we have one thing controlled, something else shows up, and aphids have become a problem the last few years. If you complain about those little Asian beetles, they were brought here to control the aphids. And so, it's a win-lose situation. Either you put up the aphids or you put up with the beetles, and sometimes I wonder which is the better of the evils. One of the big things that we've really been working on is fertilizer management. This not only there's no point in putting more input costs than you need to, but it's also very good for our groundwater. There's other diseases, cyst nematodes. We thought we just had that under control in southern Minnesota, and then they started raising beans in the Red River Valley, and it's just moved right up north with those beans. So, you continually have to keep on top of that type of thing. And probably one of our biggest problems is iron deficiency chlorosis, and if you drive by a bean field and see a large yellow area, it's not hard to diagnose what the problem is in that field, because that's what it is. Biodiesel has been a very good product for our industry. It's tended to be on a roller coaster the last few years simply because the national government will fund the blender's credit, and then they don't fund it, and then they do fund it, and it's really kind of hard to keep production going when you're not sure if you're going to get that money. Since the trans fat issue came into the picture, we are selling less soybean oil into the food industry because soybean oil, when it is hydrogenated or solidified, it has trans fats. And so, of course, the cooking food industry has frowned on that lately. So biodiesel has been a salvation there because they've taken up the excess oil. Out of every 60 bushels of soybeans, you have 11 pounds of oil, and that has to go somewhere, especially if you're going to crush for meal for the animal market. So until we can get around, they are working on beans that will no longer have the trans fat issue, but those things don't happen overnight, so we're working on that one. Biodiesel industry has, even with setbacks, has continued to grow every year and has continued to produce. Probably one of the best things that has come out of that is its linkage it has created between vegetable oil and the crude oil market. Used to be oil was sold on the food market. Now oil is sold on the crude oil market. So when the barrel of oil goes up, the price of soybean oil also goes up with it. And right now we're sitting at a 59-cent pound price level. So that's been very good for us. In Minnesota, thanks to our mandate, our 5%, we use 40 million gallons of B5, and we only produce 33 million of that in-state. So we are able to maintain our production companies and to keep that production going. I think that basically covers what I was going to cover, and if you have any questions, between Jerry and I, hopefully we can answer them.
Any committee members have any questions for either Ms. Overly or for Mr. Schoenfeld? Yes, Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Point six on your slide right there, biotech, and you referenced some resistance. Could you specifically, what are you running into for resistance, and could you speak more to that?
Mainly the European Union they have laws against biotech foods into their food strain. They allow it into their animal feed, but not into their human consumption.
Senator Nino?
And Mr. Chair, what do you mean by biotech? Are you talking about genetically modified?
Genetically modified, yes.
Okay. Other committee members have questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
I hate to correct my boss here, in a sense. But,
oh, don't do it.
But there were a couple of things that I just wanted to point out. I think the comment was made that there were 11 pounds of oil for 60 bushels. It's 11 pounds per 60 pounds. There's 60 pounds in a bushel.
Well, 60 pounds.
So it's 11 out of 60, which is a little dramatically different than 60 bushels. The other thing is that she mentioned that there was about 33 million production units going on right now in Minnesota on biodiesel, and we use about 40 million. But there is a capacity for 63 million in the state. One of our plants in Soymore down in Albert Lee, I think in Senator Sparks' district, was closed, but it is being considered to be reopened now. And one of the things that was overly mentioned was that the federal tax credit, which is $1 per gallon, was not renewed during the discussion of the health care bill last year. They didn't get around to much other than the health care bill, so it took a long time to renew it. It finally was renewed in December, and it was not only renewed going forward for a year, but it was also renewed retroactively. So people that did not get those monies in the previous year will be receiving a check from the federal government for that tax credit. And it has gone forward now, and that has really done a lot. There's one other thing I'd like to bring up, and that is that on the federal level, there's something called RFS2 on the biodiesel area, and that is the renewable fuel standard. And to give you some idea what impact this will have upon biodiesel production in the country, the best year biodiesel ever had was about 700 million gallons that were blended and consumed in 2008. Last year, because of the loss of the tax credit for that year, it dropped to 330 million gallons, so less than half of what it had been. This year, however, there is an 800 million gallon requirement for this year under the renewable fuel standard. In addition to that, there's something called advanced biofuels, and there is a 4 billion gallon requirement for that starting in 2 years. And The only fuel that presently meets the requirements of advanced biofuels is biodiesel. They're working on butanol and some other kinds of fuels to also meet that standard. But presently, the only one is advanced for the advanced biofuels is biodiesel. So the point is that with the reinstitution of the tax credit and with the requirements on the federal level in the fuel stream across the country, there is a much brighter future than we had a year ago when we had some, quite frankly, a lot of bankruptcies and so forth that followed a lot of the rest of the economy.
Thank you. Any other, Senator Nino?
Yeah, I do have one other question. You sparked an inquisitive memory here. In Isanti County, there's Evercat Fuels. There's a new process, the McGuigan process, I think they call it. And I haven't talked to them in a while. Do they use I know they can use waste oils. Did they use soybeans as well, or is that something that could become competition for biodiesel derived?
It's not a competition because they produce biodiesel.
Yeah.
And biodiesel is a methyl ester. It is produced from many feedstocks, including waste oils, such as fryers from McDonald's, soybean oil directly. Corn oil could be used, and in some cases is. Canola oil, rapeseed oil. There are many feedstocks, the oil products that can be used for this, including such things as tallow and animal fats as well. And in the case of Evercat, they're doing very well. And so they are producing, they're a smaller biodiesel plant, and I think they're at about 1.5 million gallons. Looking to go to about 3.5 million in the future. At least that's their discussions. And in that particular case, they are using whatever feedstock is most plentiful, available, and cheapest at the time that will meet the standards. And I bring up about meeting the standards because I know Senator Scoy probably better than anybody in this committee understands difficulties that biodiesel has had in the past with some of the quality standards. I am happy to report to you that the quality issues, to my knowledge and the knowledge of the petroleum marketers and others, are now gone, hopefully never to return. And the reason that that is because that they have changed the biodiesel formulations to lower the glycerin, the monoglycerins that existed in the fuel, which was causing some filter plugging. And the only reason I bring that up relative to Evercat is, depending upon the feedstock, it can have some variances in terms of the ability to produce a certain quality of biodiesel. And so what you might be able to burn in the summertime at almost 100% may not work when it's 20 below. On the other hand, we have figured out ways to make it work when it's 20 below, but it is sometimes dependent upon the feedstock. So Evercat may or may not always be able to meet that highest standard.
Any other members have any questions for Ms. Overly or Mr. Schoenfeld? If not, thank you very much for presenting your overview today. We certainly appreciate it. And next we'll have Bruce Cleven from Cleven Law Offices, and he'll be presenting an overview on the for the wheat growers, the barley, turf, potato, and sugar beet industry. And if you would state your name and your position for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Cleven, and I'll go through each of these groups as we move along, Mr. Chairman. Most of these groups are 4 or 5 hours away from the Capitol, which is really why I was hired in the first place 17 years ago, was to represent them here because they're up in Grand Forks and places like that. I do run the risk of having the same person talk for a long time here, so in order to avoid that, I'll just give you the high points of these industries this afternoon. First, let's take the Minnesota Association of Wheat Growers. Wheat is one of those grains that has been around for thousands and thousands of years. It's the widest consumed human food in the world. It's been grown in Minnesota since at least statehood, if not before. And a nod to Senator Key last year on the Ag Committee, it was responsible for the development of Minneapolis as a booming city in the flower days. In fact, there's pictures of wagon trains with oxen going back and forth from Moorhead on what is now Interstate 94. Wheat has been grown in all parts of the states and probably in most of your districts at one time or another, but right now 95% of it comes from the Red River Valley in the Northwest, and that has to do with the climate. It's a cool season crop. It does not like to get hot. And the Northwest is a perfect place to grow the wheat. It requires about 100 days of frost-free growth, and so wheat is planted as early as it can be, sometimes as early as March, but then you run the risk of frost in May when the seedlings come up. Just a little bit of frost can knock them out. So you can do it earlier, but you got to run the risk of frost. A bushel of wheat weighs about 60 pounds, and it contains a million kernels in that bushel. An acre of land provides enough wheat for 2,500 loaves of bread. There are two types of wheat planted in the U.S. There's hard red spring and hard red winter. And the winter wheat is generally from Nebraska south. Kansas has a lot of winter wheat. It's planted in the fall. It goes dormant over the winter, and then when the spring comes, it finishes out. Spring wheat is the primary one grown in Minnesota, and the reason for that is the protein. The use of the hard red spring wheat is for baking, of course, bread, buns, rolls, etc. And the hard red spring has the highest protein of all the wheat classes. There is a third type. It's kind of a minor one in Minnesota, and that's Durum wheat. That's used for pasta. The bulk of that is over on the North Dakota side. So it's a minor crop in Minnesota, but nevertheless, it's important to the industry. The Minneapolis Grain Exchange, just as a footnote, is the only spring wheat futures trading place in the world. In fact, for 50 years, as I mentioned, Minneapolis was an important flour milling point. And going back to 1904, I found this stat interesting. About 100 years ago, the amount of flour coming out of the mills over there was so much that if you took all of the barrels and stacked them up, they would be higher than the IDS tower by 70 times. And that's how much wheat came out of those mills per day back in 1904. Chicago, eastern cities, bakeries, they have been important destinations over the years. Much of the wheat grown here is actually sold through export. If it doesn't run through a mill, it goes out on a unit train to the West Coast, or it goes through the Port of Duluth. And the Port of Duluth has been very helpful in keeping the railroad shipping rates honest over the years, because if they go up too high, then they just send it out through the St. Lawrence Seaway. A couple of things on acreage. Minnesota wheat acreage peaked in the 80s at about 2.4 million acres. It's down now to about 1.6, and there are generally two reasons for that. One was the outbreak of scab in 1993. Senator Scoy, Stumpf, and others remember that. Scab is a fungus that attacks the head. It came all of a sudden one year when 1993 was wet, and there was some thinking at the time that ironically conservation tillage was responsible for the growth of the spores because the spores had a place to live in the corn residue and in the stubble over the winter. And then when the hot humid conditions came the next, it just exploded out the valley. So that was one of the causes. And the second then was the development of cooler season soybean varieties. As you get up north, again, the frost is different than in the southern part of the state. And as the varieties developed and they could have shorter growing seasons, the soybeans moved north, and that displaced a lot of the wheat acres. Just a quick note on the top issues the wheat growers are looking at here at the legislature. The breeding program at the University of Minnesota is probably the number one thing for them. And the reason for that is the university, as a land-grant college, has historically been the place to go for wheat variety development. The private seed companies have tended to focus on corn and soybeans and some of the other crops. But the public varieties have always come out of the University of Minnesota, North Dakota, and other places. And so the growers are very concerned about that program over there for the Ag Extension Service and the experiment stations. I would also note, too, that it was mentioned in the soybean growers, there's a checkoff system where the growers can contribute a penny or two per bushel, and a lot of that money winds up in the research programs over there. The wheat growers also support AURI. They pay close attention to wetland and drainage issues. Part of that has to do with the fact that wheat doesn't like what we call wet feet. Wet feet are wet roots. Soybeans don't like wet feet either. And so we need to get that water away from them during the growing season. Ag chemical restriction bills, we've paid close attention to those over the years. We don't care for them particularly. And then transportation, both infrastructure and trucking regulations are important to the growers. So, Mr. Chairman, that's my report on the wheat side. If you'd like to take questions on that before I move on, that'd be fine with me.
Any committee members have any questions for Mr. Clavin on the wheat from the Wheat Growers Association? Seeing none, if you want to move on to the barley.
Sure. Barley can be short, Mr. Chairman. The group I work for is the Minnesota Barley Growers Association. And the reason this is short is because it's very similar to wheat. Same climate, same growth pattern, same structure, same issues. One distinguishing feature of barley, at least from the road as you drive by it, and when you look out and you see a field of barley, it looks bushier than wheat would. And so to the trained eye, you can tell the difference in the fields based on what the head looks like in July. It's also harvested a couple of weeks earlier. The spring wheat is harvested in August, and barley is more at the end of July. Historically, on barley, there was two markets usually for barley. You would grow for malt and hope you made malt grade, and then if you didn't, you had feed. Back when we had more acres and before scab, the maltsters had a lot of barley to choose from. And so the standard would seem to fluctuate a little bit. One year when there was a shortage, the standard would be a little bit lower, and then when there was a lot of barley, the standard was higher. Over the years, the maltsters have started to contract all the barley. And because of the variance in price, no one really grows barley just to grow barley. You don't really grow it for the feed. You could grow corn. And so the feed barley market has all but disappeared, and basically all the barley now is contracted. That trend has been going on for about 15 years. Barley 15 years ago would have seen about 1 million acres in Minnesota. Now it's down to 100,000. So it's really dropped off. And again, it has to do with the malting contracts, but also the advent of the soybeans moving north as well. We've got a couple of major brewers in Minnesota for the industry. You'll find those in New Ulm, the Shell Brewing down there, Summit over here in St. Paul, Minnesota Brewing in St. Paul, and Glick up in Cold Spring, although that might have closed. I can't remember. And they use Minnesota-grown barley as well as Canadian. We also have four malt plants. Again, the price premium is in malting barley. And those are in Moorhead, of course. There's one down in Winona, and Cannon Falls, and then Rahr down in Shakopee. And so those plants produce malt. The issues and concerns for the barley growers really mirror that of the wheat growers with the breeding program, AURI, transportation, wetlands, drainage, and ag chemicals. And so that's really the quick overview of the barley industry, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Mr. Clavin on the barley overview? Having none, we'll move to the turf.
All right, Mr. Chairman, groups I represent here, the Minnesota Turf Seed Council, and there's a secondary group called the Northern Seed Trade Association. They work on similar issues here at the legislature. The Minnesota turf seed industry was actually on a steady rise for the last several years until the recession hit. And when the recession hit, that caused a severe drop in the demand for sod for new houses and golf courses and things like that. And so the industry has got a bunch of full warehouses up in Williams and Roseau up in Kitson County, Roseau County. If you're looking for seed, they've got plenty for you. But the recession really caused a drop in production. Last year, there was about 30,000 acres devoted to turf seed production in the state. And again, that's concentrated up in the northwest corner because of the cool season. Grass seed production is actually similar to wheat and barley in that if you let the grass grow long enough, if you don't mow it like you do on your lawn, it starts to grow like wheat and head out, and there gets to be a head on it. And you can swat that and lay it in windrows to dry it out, or you can take it with a straight reel head. And so the grass seed industry uses the similar machinery as you'd find in wheat and barley, even the same drills to some extent. One of the issues that has come up here in the last couple of years, and Mr. Chairman, we'll be revisiting you on this issue with your budget bill, and that's the grass seed variety project. Up in Roseau, they're starting to use the hulls on a gasification project where the hulls are burned under pressure to create renewable energy. And they've been working on that for 2 years, and we've got a line item in the ag budget bill for that. So as the budget bill is assembled, we'll probably be down to give you further testimony on that if you'd like. But that's one of the issues they have. Second issue for the turf seed industry has to do with LCMR, Lassard, DNR, Bowser, all the conservation practices where the grass is grown for seed on those projects. There's been a couple of bills around here that have caused the growers a lot of trouble on bidding projects. Chapter 84.02 has a number of definitions about restricting how far the seed can go on a state project, preferably within 25 miles or even in the same county. So if the grass seed comes from Kitson County and the conservation easement is down in by Winona, you're not going to make that, and that's caused a lot of problems. We've tried to repeal that. In fact, I think the Senate has probably passed that in various bills five or six times, and we're running it again this year. The second is to delete some language on, I'll just simply refer to the extent possible. And that also shows up in the LCMR bill and in the Lessard bill and says to the extent possible you have to use local ecotype varieties. And that, again, makes the bidding process very hard for the growers, and so they'd like to see that deleted wherever it appears in statute. So, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the brief summary on the turf industry, and again, I'm reserving some of that in the event we work on your budget bill.
All right. Any questions on the turf? We'll head on to the next.
All right.
Mr. Clavin.
Mr. Chairman, the next industry here is the potato growers. And at the outset, I'm going to mention to all the members that Senator Skoy is an active, real-life potato grower and knows far more about this than I do. And so I would invite him to fill in here in any of the gaps that he'd like, but I'm not going to pretend to upstage him on that. The group formerly now out of East Grand Forks is called the Northern Plains Potato Growers Association. For many decades, it was called the Red River Valley Potato Growers Association, and they changed their name because a number of the acres shifted into North Dakota. Actually, quite a few of them have, because of center pivot irrigation. Irrigated potatoes come out more uniform. You don't necessarily need the water for the growing, but if you irrigate them uniformly, they come out, and there's some market issues on chipping and processing that make that desirable. So as the acres shifted, it got out of the Red River Valley, and now a lot of it, probably 70% of the potatoes in North Dakota, Minnesota, come from that central irrigated region in North Dakota. So that's the reason for the name change. As you all know, the potato, you all have eaten them, seen them in the grocery store, it's a tuber, it's a root crop, and the potato grows underground with the leaves above ground, and they act as a big solar panel, and everything gets stored down in the root. Potatoes in Minnesota are planted again in late April or early May, as soon as the ground temperature is warm and dry enough to take the seed. Potato production requires a lot of money, both from the investment in the equipment and in the production inputs and in the warehousing for storage. Potato production is not measured by bushels. Instead, it's measured by hundredweights. And you'll see that vernacular thrown around. I've got so many hundredweights. What's the yield? It's so many bags per acre. The last stat I have here available is the average yield for potatoes in Minnesota is approximately 350 100-pound bags per acre, except on the Skoy farm, which is probably a lot higher. I don't know if that number is accurate or not. Harvest will begin in the middle of September, and they want to let the growing season grow long enough to fill that potato out, but they got to catch it before the first frost, certainly before the hard freeze. So September is a main month for harvesting potatoes. The growers have to use a specialized harvester that takes them out of the ground. A truck goes alongside, and bruising on potatoes is really an issue. You get potato bruising, not only does it hurt your marketing, but the bruises, if there are too many, can start to spoil. Then it starts to heat up the warehouse and ruins the whole lot. Kind of the one bad apple analysis. So bruised potatoes can be a problem. Once the potatoes are harvested, most of them go to farmer-owned warehouses. They are not grain bins, but they're big storage sheds. They're dumped in conveyors, and the dirt and the clumps and the clods are sifted out, and they're put back in the warehouse. And that is partly what makes Minnesota and North Dakota ideal for potato production, is our climate. You know, when it was 20 below last week, that was really good for the fans. You know, you could put that into the warehouse, natural cooler. Potatoes are highly perishable and need to be handled with care. In Minnesota, the industry has got a concentration in the Red River Valley, but there's also a bunch in the central part around Big Lake and some of that area, Sherburne County. They use irrigators there, so that makes production good for them. There are really four markets that potatoes are grown for. There's four kinds. It's not just what you find in the store. The first one is seed. Some potatoes are grown just for seed. So if I'm a potato seed grower, I'm going to grow seed, sell it to Senator Skoy on whatever variety he's looking to put in. This is a little bit of a risk because you've got to look 2 and 3 years out to get your certified stock up and running to have enough seed for him to buy. And so the seed growers have to kind of anticipate where the market's going to go in a couple of years, and so that makes it a little bit risky for them. Second is the fresh market. And most folks are familiar with the fresh market. That's the direct consumer purchase that you might have. Fresh markets, potatoes are harvested. They run through a wash plant where they're literally washed off and simply put in a bag. There's no other processing that's really required for that potato. The bags come in 5, 10, 20, 50, or 100-pound bags, and they're sold to grocery stores and restaurants. The most common examples you might be familiar with are the small red potatoes that you might put some olive oil and rosemary on, perhaps, small red skin. And then the second one is going to be a boiling potato or a baking potato, which is a long red russet.
I missed something.
All right, along has the white inside, and that's the baking potato. That's referred to as a russet. All right, third market is processing. Some potatoes are grown strictly for processing, and there you will see frozen hash browns, French fries, those kind of things. Those are grown variety-wise just for processing. The starch content and the sugar content are important. There's a plant in Grand Forks, and the brand name here that you might recognize is Orida, for example. That's processing. And then lastly are chipping. Some potatoes are grown strictly for a chipping market. The size, the roundness, and then the color of the inside is grown just for the chip market. There used to be a huge chip market here until Frito-Lay pulled out about, 93 or so out of the valley. They canceled the contracts, and they went down to Texas. And a lot of the potato acres went away. Chipping potatoes need to be uniform and have good frying characteristics. There is a plant, Barrel of Fun, for example, up in Park Rapids, is a chipping plant that processes just chipping potatoes. Top issues for the potato growers, probably really only two here. Again, it's transportation, getting the product to and from, and then ag chemical restrictions. We've seen those bills over the years, and the potato growers pay close attention to that as well. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my remarks on the potato industry for you. I don't know if Senator Scoy wants to add anything to that.
I think Senator Kelash has a question.
Just wondering, the number of acres of potatoes have gone down. You see more varieties in the supermarkets with Yukons and everything else. Are we entering those markets and other specialty kinds of potatoes that seem to be starting to gain traction in grocery stores and higher-end restaurants, et cetera?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelash, yeah, that's all part of the whole the whole picture with the potato industry. The varieties, there's dozens of varieties. Yukon Gold is one of them. Black Gold is another. White Russet, Shepherdy, Red Pontiac is one of the table varieties. So if those growers are growing those for those markets, certainly that's been going on for a number of years.
Okay. Is he right about that, Senator Scoy?
I was just taking a little snooze during that part.
No, all about
Mr. Chair, actually, that is correct. And as potato industry is the fresh market part has expanded into this, you're seeing more and more growers raising more and more different varieties. There's now a yellow fleshed red potato, which is going to be out and around, and all kinds of different stuff. So great. It's very interesting.
Very good. Okay, continue on.
All right. Last, Mr. Chairman, we have a Minnesota sugar beet industry, and this is not listed as an association, and the reason is there are three separate sugar beet cooperatives in operation in the state here, and I'll get to that in a minute. The sugar beet is actually very similar to the potato in that it's a root crop grown like a carrot or a potato. The sugar beet grows underground. It's in the same family as the red beet, but it's quite a bit different as a plant. The beet crop grows underground, and the leaves are really like solar panels, much more so than the potatoes are. If you remember your seventh grade-ish math on photosynthesis, the sunlight comes into the leaves and it's converted into sugars, we want those panels as big as possible because everything is going to run down in that root. The only marketable use for a sugar beet anywhere, any place, is to make it into granulated sugar that you buy in the bag. It's the only market for that product whatsoever. And because of that, you have to have a place to take the beet. You can't just grow beets and look at them or cut them up yourself. You have to have a plant to take them to. And so in order to grow them, you got to have shares in the plant. Beets are a highly perishable commodity, and they require timely hauling during the harvest season and the processing. Unlike other crops, there is no on-farm storage for beets at all. Never has been. The sugar beets are grown in 12 states. In Minnesota, most folks don't know this, Minnesota is number one in sugar beet production. far and away. We have about 500,000 acres here. Number two is North Dakota with 250, about half. So we have more beet acres than any state in the union here. The first beet planted in the country was out in California by a guy named Klaus Spreckels. He was a German immigrant in about 1870. He brought the beet over from Germany and planted, and they started to plant, and they called the company Spreckels Sugar, and of course that was out in Spreckels, California. That shifted through Wyoming and Colorado and eventually made its way here. The first beet planted in Minnesota was by a guy named Ferdinand Ross, another German immigrant, out a few miles west of Crookston in a town called Fisher, Minnesota, in 1926. And they found that the beets grew really well in that Red River Valley soil. So the American Crystal Company, headquartered in Denver, decided to put a plant here in East Grand Forks in 1926, and that's what started the industry in the state. For a number of years, American Crystal operated out of Denver and had plants, and they built another one in Moorhead in 1948, and there were a couple in the 50s. And eventually they stopped investing, and the growers wanted to grow the beets, and so in 1973 they simply bought the company, and it was the first real value-added farmer cooperative in the country. It was American Crystal Growers bought that company in 1973. As I mentioned, there are three companies, American Crystal being one of them. They have five factories, three in Minnesota and two on the North Dakota side. I should mention as a footnote that all of the expansions happen on the North Dakota side. PCA compliance is a big issue here. It doesn't seem to be so much in Bismarck, but it is here. The second company is in Wahpeton, North Dakota. That's called Mindac Farmers Cooperative. They started in 1975, built a factory in Wahpeton. And then the last one is in Renville, Senator Kubley's district. The Southern Minnesota Sugar Company started in 1974. And those are the three companies that make up the industry. Again, beets, like the rest of the crops, planted in late April. The thing about planting beets, though, is that the ground temperature has to be 50 degrees overnight before you can put the beets in. Otherwise, it gets too cold for them. They run the risk of frost as well. They're fussy to get out of the ground, both from an emergent standpoint and from a harvesting standpoint. Like potatoes, beets require a lot of specialized equipment, a lot of investment by the growers, both on the machinery end, in the stock end, in the factory, on the inputs, and then during harvesting. Yield is about 22 tons an acre now, and about 17% of that beet is recoverable sugar. Beet seeds are smaller than a pencil eraser, and they're all grown in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. And the reason for that is that a sugar beet is actually a two-year crop. The first year the seed makes the root, as we've been talking about, and then the leaves go out like this. When we harvest that beet, chop the leaves off and take the root out. That's what we want. If it's left over winter and gets to the second year, a stalk starts to shoot out the top. And again, like grass and wheat and barley, it starts to shoot out and flower out and head. And all the seeds sit in that head. So basically, to get beet seed in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, you swat it and combine it just like it was wheat. And it all comes from there because it survives the winter. Harvest here begins in September, and the window for getting beets out is very narrow. You got about 3 weeks. The reason for that is you ideally want to catch the first frost because it tricks the plant into stopping growing for a while, and the sucrose runs out of the leaves and stores in the roots. So you want to get that first frost in September, but you got to get them out of the ground before the hard freeze, which comes up in the valley as early as Halloween or a week before. So you got a narrow window. That's why we take them out 24 hours a day when the beet harvest starts in the first week of October. As I mentioned, there's no on-farm storage, so all the beets go into great big piles. And there's pilers that sift out the dirt and put them in about 100,000-ton piles. Most piling stations take about 10,000 acres of capacity. When they get to the plant, the beets are washed and processed and granulated into the bag in about a two-hour time frame. And I was to tell you, Mr. Chairman and members, you have a standing invitation to tour a factory. If you haven't done it, it's really a fascinating place. People often ask about quickly what is the process. It's actually very simple. Beets are washed. They're cut up into French fries called cassettes. And that way the sugar molecules can be extracted easier instead of just in the big bulk. So they're cut up into French fries. They're run through this big tumbler, which is probably a football field in length practically. It's a huge tumbler. And in that tumbler is water.
Think about, there were some ads in the 70s about a rock tumbler, K-Tel product, sits and turns. Well, the water goes like that, and the beets are run, the french fries are run through this way. And through a process of osmosis is what it's called, the water pulls the cell out of the pulp. The sucrose cell is pulled out, and it's put in that water. When it comes out the other end, the pulp goes out here, and that's sold for cattle feed. The juice now is what's called thick juice. It's a brownish liquid, and it's got the molecules in it. Well, from there, it's run through a tank, a fermenting tank. And at the top, some crystals are dropped in the top, and you can literally look in the window and watch the crystals float down like snowflakes, and it turns that thick juice into crystals. And now you've got what looks like wet brown sugar at the end. So from there, it's taken into literally a washing machine, dumped in a batch, and you can pull the cover up and watch the centrifugal force spin like a drying cycle on your clothes, and you can see it go from brown to white as the molasses is pulled off there, as the brownness is pulled off. So after that step, you've got white, wet granules and molasses. The white sugar is then dried and bagged. And if you want brown sugar, you take some back and dump in some molasses, and that's what adds the color. A lot of people think you stop with the wet brown, but you got to finish the drying, and then you add the color back in. All right, just to finish up here, the bulk of the sugar grown here goes to industrial manufacturers like Hershey, Nestle, General Mills on cereal. The only one that you'll see in the grocery store from Minnesota is American Crystal, pure, proud, and sweet, not C&H. Not C&H, American Crystal. But the bulk of it goes through on rail cars to bakeries and so forth. The top issues for the growers here at the legislature, MPCA permits, compliance rules, regulations, fines, etc., has gotten to be a big deal. And it's a big deal for the growers because the growers own the factories. And that comes out of their pocket, all these rules that we have. Secondly is transportation. Transportation is a big deal. We've worked on bills about weight. Senator Scoy has carried a number of those over the years. Ag chemicals, another one. Again, it's the same for all the groups. And then wetlands and drainage, because beets also don't like wet feet. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my prepared remarks on the sugar beet industry for you.
Okay, any questions? Senator Rosen has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, how could anybody make a sugar refinery interesting? We were spellbounded. I'm seriously. Only Bruce Claven can do that. It was fascinating.
Rosen, I think it's just because he's a farm boy from southwestern Minnesota.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's got to be it. I mean, I'm overwhelmed. I only got part of the presentation. So,
Mr. Chair, I do have a question, though.
Yes.
And I did grow up next to the plant in Longmont. The American Crystal plant. Mr. Claven, do you know where is Florida in the sugar beet production as far as number of acres? Are they up there? And do you know of any work they're doing on renewables with the sugar beets out there?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, that's a two-part question. The Florida one first. Generally, actually, going back to George Washington times, the United States has always been a net importer of sweeteners, and not just granulated, but also the high fructose corn syrup and cane. We produce about 80% right now in the form of high fructose granulated beet and granulated cane. The rest of it's imported. Of that 80%, about 50% is beet and 50% is cane. So the states that grow the cane are Florida, Louisiana, a little bit of Texas, and Hawaii used to have a lot, but their industry is way down. So Louisiana actually is building a new refinery right now in their state. So Florida, I'm going to say, has probably been steady. They've had some issues at the Everglades, and there was a settlement with the U.S. Sugar Corp down there. They've been pretty flat for a while, and they've just been cranking out their 50%. On the renewable side, there's a project going on in North Dakota, out in Jamestown, where some guys are taking the beet and cutting it up and using it for energy, for biomass. It's in the early stages. They've proven that it can work. But one of the issues always is going to be the economies of scale. Could you grow that beet with all the investment that you make to make that feasible? So it's in the early stages, and the project is going on in Jamestown. I'm sure our association up in Fargo would have some more information on that. I think the name of the company is called Green Vision, if I remember correctly. And if you'd like some material on that, I can make a note to send that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Claver.
Okay. Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Clavin, could you just update us on the issues affecting beet growers? You didn't mention the GMO issue and the seeds.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of discussion up in our area about that.
Mr. Clavin.
There is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stump, the issue that's been asked here is about Roundup Ready or genetically modified beets. Keeping weeds out of sugar beets has been a challenge going back to Ferdinand Ross's first crop in 1926. Because beets are a broadleaf crop, there are, there are grass crops like wheat and corn, and there's broadleafs, potatoes, beets, and soybeans, etc. There are families of weeds that are close to beets. Red root pigweed is one of the bad ones. Black nightshade is another one. Cocklebur sunflowers, they're all similar in family. So getting rid of those has always been a challenge. Hand labor used to go through in, for most of the beet production years. And so the growers have always wanted the Roundup Ready. They've been waiting for it for a number of years. It's been out since 2008, so we just finished the third crop of using Roundup Ready beets. Well, there was an approval process with USDA that goes back to 2005. 2005, the USDA said, we're going to let the beets go Roundup. And if you remember the seed production, it's a two-year process. So the companies out in the Willamette Valley started ramping up, and they put the gene in, and they had enough acres to make it commercial by 2008. We put the first crop in, and some organic growers in California near Willamette Valley brought a lawsuit saying the USDA didn't do an environmental impact statement. The USDA never did an environmental impact statement on soybeans or any of the other stuff that's gone on since 1989. So a lawsuit was brought in California in the Ninth Circuit, which historically is a favorable venue for plaintiffs, and Judge Jeffrey White agreed with them and said, yep, you got to do an EIS. So that was argued for during the 2009 crop that was argued over. And last August of 2010, the appeals were done, and the judge said, yep, no more Roundup Ready beets until the USDA completes the EIS. And by the way, you got to plow up all the seed growing in the Willamette Valley for the 2012 crop. That appeal was reversed by the appeals court, and that's where we sit today. We can grow the crop with permits until the EIS is completed. That's the status as of February 15th, 2011. Subject to change by another lawsuit.
Good question, Senator. Good question. Senator Kalash?
On almost all of these different crops, you've said that the permitting process is an issue and talked about some of those things. Is there anything specific that's slowing down the process, or is there anything specific with these crops or these processing plants that makes them more difficult to permit that we should be aware of?
Mr. Clavin?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Kalash, it's really in the general conversation, which you actually had a few weeks ago in this very room on the Environment Committee. I know one of the plant expansions, I forget what it was for, they had to do the same thing to all five factories. And in the North Dakota side, the permit was issued in less than a month, and on the Minnesota side, it took a year. The Renville factory, their air permit, it's a five-year permit, has taken a couple years to get done. We always run into this incompleteness, it seems, at the PCA. I wish I had better information for you on that, but it's that general kind of slowdown that they've seen. And they're comparing it to North Dakota. That's their benchmark. I don't know what it's like in Illinois, for example, but when they compare it to North Dakota, it's vastly different.
Follow up. And so what we're saying is it's not specifically the standards, it's just the time it takes to get the permit. Yep. Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Clavin?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kalash, I think that would be a fair statement. A lot of the stuff they deal with air and water is going to be federally handed down. Sometimes there's an interpretation issue. I know there was an issue last fall in the Renville factory about water temperature being 1 degree too much. And so that was the PCA thought that was out of compliance, for example. I don't know much about the facts about that, but it's things like that. You wouldn't hear that in North Dakota. They'd just say, go raise some more.
Thank you.
Any other comments for Mr. Clavin? Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you may have mentioned this. I had to step out for a minute, but did you mention the economic impact and the number of people that are actually employed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, I did not mention the economic impact, Senator Stump. There was a study done by NDSU probably 8-10 years ago. The economic impact of the sugar beet industry in the state, and would include the eastern part of North Dakota because it's the industry, was in excess of $3 billion. The estimates on employees, boy, I don't know if I could get to that because of the varying factors, but we have folks running the pilers 24 hours a day. There's two crews for that. All the truck drivers that come in. A lot of folks, for example, in Crookston will take their vacation, drive beet truck for 2 weeks. They start on a Friday at midnight when they throw the switch up at American Crystal, because then you catch Saturday and Sunday, and you get in the, and folks do that. There's a lot of part-time help for the industry up in the valley.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Good job today, Chris. Unfortunately, Ms. Beth Nelson was not able to make it today, but we do have information in your packet concerning the Minnesota Canola Council. It seems like a growing industry. I would point out a new processing plant broke ground just last month and up in Halleck, Minnesota, so obviously they're planning on growing that industry. Again, canola is an oilseed crop similar to soybean, sunflower, and what have you. It stands for Canadian low linoleic acid rapeseed. Minnesota Wild Rice is another organization that she represents. And Minnesota is the second largest producer of cultivated wild rice in the world. And, of course, we're all familiar with the reputation Minnesota has for wild rice. The Minnesota alfalfa and forage industry is another important industry. Lots of folks are involved in that, producing not only livestock feed but other products from the alfalfa industry and forage industry. So members, feel free to take those with you or keep those in your folders if you wish. I also would like to point out again that today is Dairy Day. The reception tonight at the Kelly Inn, I believe, starting at 5 o'clock, is it? Or 5 o'clock, and we'll go. Yeah, there he is back there. And do you want to say any comments, Mr. Are you still president? Come on up and tell us a little bit. And I do want to recognize my friend and our friend, a friend of agriculture, friend of dairy, Farmer Representative Greg Blaine, who... at the time he was serving in the legislature with myself and others, I was a dairy farmer, and I can remember many nights, Greg, you saying you were going home and driving up to Little Falls to milk the cows and do that. And I can't tell you there's too many people that would do that. So I know firsthand the work you went through and the sacrifice you made, Greg, to serve the citizens of the state of Minnesota, and great to see you again.
It's great to see you, Mr. Chairman, and... You look good, and Dallas, you keep more hair than me.
Thank you, Greg. Pat, what do you got to tell us today about the dairy industry?
Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself for the tape and continue on.
Patrick Luneman, president of Minnesota Milk Producers and dairy farmer in Todd County, not too far from where Greg Blaine lives. I've got one key item, but I'm going to do a few housekeeping items first, if I could. And I know that a couple of weeks ago you heard an overview of the industry from Bob Lefebvre, so I will not go there. We understand that the legislature has serious budget concerns, but we have some programs that I want to talk about here. The Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program, which is run by the Department of Ag. We believe it's a critical program to help small and young producers, and it coordinates industry support. So for every dollar that's put into that, I think it's magnified many times by the industry people that help out in the process. And in the last 3 years, this program has been cut one-third, so it's already had significant funding cuts. And we're concerned that if there are more cuts, that it will jeopardize the core program. The Livestock Investment Grant, it's been a tremendous investment stimulator to the dairy industry and other livestock in past years. And we know that the budget's tight. we would like you to consider maybe an investment credit instead so that it doesn't have a direct significant impact on the budget. And for sure, make sure you keep the program so that down the road maybe we can use this program to stimulate investment in our industry. Environmental permitting, I know that you're having discussions about that within the dairy industry and livestock in general. We encourage you to streamline, shorten timelines, and eliminate the redundancy in the regulatory agencies. The Board of Soil and Research, which you know as Bowser, we ask you to continue the outdoor heritage funding and the funds that are from that to help our small and medium-sized producers come into compliance in their feedlots. We're afraid that some of the small producers that we have, with the costs that they would have to bring their feedlots into full compliance under the 2010 rule, which there are some guidelines that they're still okay at this point, that with those costs without help, they may just throw in the towel and say it's time to stop. And we feel that would be a sad day for those dairy farms in Minnesota. They're part of our economy, and we need to continue to support them. We ask you to support healthy options in schools, the placement of milk in the lunch lines, vending machines, and stores, including flavored milk. Flavored milk has come under a considerable amount of fire lately as not being healthy, but when you take flavored milk away from students in schools, consumption of milk goes down 30%, and the students then turn to less healthy options than flavored milk. So we have to be careful what we do in this arena. We'd also like you to consider increase in solid non-fat standards in fluid milk. This is something that's done in California. And I'm just throwing the idea on the table. The key point that I want to make today is that the Minnesota Milk Producers Association supports the establishment of the Dairy Research, Teaching, and Consumer Education Center. And last year, the legislature approved funding for a preliminary study. And the results of that study came out today from the Department of Ag. I believe they're very favorable. And we urge you to support pre-designed funding in the 2011 bonding bill. And I want to talk a little bit about the history of research in Minnesota. Some of you have probably been on the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. There's a building there called Hacker Hall. And it's named after a fellow by the name of Theo Hacker, Professor Theo Hacker. He was one of the first dairy researchers in Minnesota. He pulled together 10 Jersey cows at the university, and did research on what he fed those cows and how they milked. So he weighed every pound of feed going into those cows, different types of feed, and the milk that those cows produced. He weighed every bit of that. And then he went out into the country and his buckboard with the horses from town to town, county to county, farmer to farmer, county agent to county agent, whatever they had back in the 1800s. And that was the first part of extension in Minnesota from the University of Minnesota. And we have a colorful, wonderful history in our state here with the University of Minnesota. And we need to continue that. And I believe we're at a crossroads today where we need a new research facility that will create the next generation of research and will lead us to a new plateau in dairy innovation. And we envision a partnership that's not only the state of Minnesota, but the University of Minnesota, the MinSCU system, and private industry. We think it's time to pull all of those entities together in cooperation to have a new research facility, because we haven't had one for many, many decades. We just, we've had such good staff at the University of Minnesota, and they don't have a place to really work their research. So, Mr. Chair, I just ask you again to support the pre-design funding in the 2011 bonding bill for the Dairy Research, Teaching, and Consumer Education Center. And that concludes my remarks, and I will entertain any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Gary, folks, again. Senator Kalash.
Excuse me, can you just expand on what the limitations are of the St. Paul campus for the U and their research facility there?
Currently, there are about 90 cows there in tie stalls. And it's a It's a great facility. It's a good number of cows for students there to do hands-on application and research, and they need to have that on the St. Paul campus. And we also have a new research going on at the University of Minnesota Morris in the organic and grazing sector, which is also important. But for the typical commercial dairy as we see it today in Minnesota, we do not have a facility anymore where we can do ongoing research and the types of areas that we believe are important to grow the industry here in our state.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Luneman. And again, your reception is tonight at the Kelly Inn starting at 5 o'clock, right?
Yes, and we encourage all of you to attend and hope to see you there.
And thanks a lot for the milk.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll get the that Department of Agriculture study out that President Luneman talked about to the members, and maybe even at time, if we can, to have a presentation on it. But we'll get that out to you. That was released today. Next Thursday, we're going to start reviewing the budget. The Department of Ag come in and go through the governor's budget and start to look at in-depth detail of what the situation is there and plan on taking whatever time it takes to go through those budgets. Tentatively, we are looking at a agriculture water meeting on probably the 24th. But again, that's tentatively, and to then have a presentation on what really is going on in agriculture on the water side. To find it very interesting what agriculture is really doing. We encourage the media to participate to hear our side of the story. Should be real refreshing. With that, members, thanks a lot for your attention. The meeting's adjourned.